One. Hello, and welcome to Life in the Foam. I'm Clinton, and this is the podcast all about making it on your world, shaping your digital environment, your media environment, your window onto the greater world, however you want. You can stay in the mainstream media bubbles, or you can live dangerously in the foam. And here to talk to me about that is Frederik Knudsen, who, he creates lots of fantastic YouTube videos. It's a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you very much.
So, why don't you tell us a little bit about your channel, and specifically your YouTube series Down the Rabbit Hole?
Yeah, so I make a series of documentaries on a number of different topics. The topics often have to do with the internet, but not always. And they tend to be between 15 and 45 minutes long, very podcast style. And the visuals are often there simply as supplementary material. That's about it. Like, I'm a documentarian that happens to upload his stuff to YouTube.
Right. Right. And from what I've seen most of the series now. I'd say they all tend to focus around a sort of theme, which I might call interesting or out there psychologies. I mean, the very name Down the Rabbit Hole. You tend to tell stories very well, which sort of take the viewer into some alternate headspace in a sort of a reality is stranger than fiction sort of sense.
I don't always believe that's true, that reality is stranger than fiction, but I do my best to tell a narrative, and especially with the way that the internet works nowadays, these narratives can be very sprawling and very strange, and when told in sequential order, can suck you in a lot more than you'd expect.
Yeah, absolutely. Sprawling is a good word for it, because after all, they're kind of distributed across time and space with people. For instance, your video on the Final Fantasy house.
Yes.
For people who don't know, that was 20 years ago. I mean, I was on the internet at the time, all right?
Yeah.
I was a member of the Something Awful web forums and whatnot, and so there's all sorts of... Like, that's what the internet is a whole bunch of people spending a few hours of the day just in this alternate universe talking to all sorts of different people, like, cherry-picking all the interesting stuff that happens in the world. So the Final Fantasy house was just this little group of people who decided to kind of create their own belief system and recruit people and live in a house together and pretend to sort of live in a video game. And, I mean, there's a whole bunch of scattershot details which are spread all over various blog posts and various web forums, and you actually had to go out there and kind of find all this stuff and stitch it together.
It was a little tricky. Archive.org and all the internet archiving sites are your friends.
Oh, yes.
And they often will have things that you wouldn't expect. Google Cache, surprisingly, will occasionally have something good. But the internet is kind of a weird place where things don't always die, they just decay.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right, it builds up and it builds up. It's sort of this junkyard or this thrift shop. There's this term, rag and bone shop, that was used by the poet G.K. Chesterton, I think, just to talk about the big amassment of all this stuff, which is available, but no one ever digs through. It's just sitting there. Archive.org is an excellent example, because it's... God, oh my God, they got terabytes and terabytes. They've backed up the whole World Wide Web 100 times over with snapshots again and again and again. Everything that happened on the internet, more or less.
You say that. It's surprisingly limited for, like, it's extremely useful, don't get me wrong. But there is so much that has gone unarchived.
Mm-hmm. And that could be owing to, robots.txt, for instance. Like... Websites can decide whether or not they'll let a site like Archives save their stuff or whatnot.
But, precisely. That was a big problem with the Furries video, actually.
Oh, right, right. The Furries video, that was interesting because you had to dig way back into the 70s and 80s where underground media was done more through, like, photocopying, thanks to the invention of the Xerox. Right, just... the way that back when subcultures were still explicitly identified as alternate lifestyles, I guess that was the phrase that kept getting used, right?
Yeah. People were sort of piggybacking a little bit, I think, off of the New Age movement and their acceptance of different styles of life, different sexualities, even. Like, they saw that, and then other people saw their opportunity to be legitimized as well. And so I think that's my suspicion, is that they started using similar language.
Mm-hmm.
I don't mean that in a derogatory sense.
No. Well, that's sort of part and parcel with living in a liberal, free society where people can do what they want, is that new cultures, yeah, especially after the 60s, are going to just blossom and bloom and more so in cities, I'm sure. Mm. Yeah, so that was really interesting. Both of those videos, in fact, just because it's interesting the way that the internet allows people to surround themselves with... if a city's got, 3 million people in it, and you're interested in something that only 1 in 100,000 people would care about, well, that means there's 30 of you who can get together and form a club, right?
Mm-hmm. I think that is something that I kind of wanted to address, is that I don't think that the internet has changed the way that people interact on a fundamental level. Mm-hmm. If anything, it has simply helped people to interact in the way that they would have otherwise. So with the Final Fantasy house, for example, people keep saying, oh man, this really sounds like a cult. Guess what? It is. It absolutely was a cult. It simply was using the internet as a medium by which to induct members. In fact, cults nowadays still will use the internet to induct new members. So it's old practices done with a new tool.
Mm-hmm. Well, there you go. And sometimes there can be a qualitative change that comes about from a vast quantitative increase. So you can have the same usual cult recruitment tactics going on, but the reach and the scalability of it, and the fact that we're now dealing with, billions of people with a smartphone in their pocket, means that if there's a change, it's not how things are done, but the magnitude at which it is a possibility to happen, if not is happening, right?
Yeah, precisely. And that means that there are new... what's the word? Good morning.
Good morning, Frederick. I'm a little bit tired.
I actually just got back a couple days ago from a week-long trip, so I'm still a little bit frazzled. But there are new properties that when you start to do business as usual on the internet, connecting to so many people, there are new properties that occur that can change the way that business as usual is done. So, for example, recruiting cult members can become a very different experience online as opposed to in person.
Yeah, you've only got a few minutes with the guy who stops on the street to read your pamphlet.
Whereas... Well, also when you're on the internet, people are often in a more of a comfort zone. People will often even retreat to their phones because it's a comfort zone. And if you can attack people while they feel comfortable, they can be a lot more willing to investigate something like this. I highly doubt any Christorian would go into the library and check out a bunch of books about Chris Chan. But because it's all available online at the safety of their laptop, or at their PC more likely, it's more likely that they're willing to dig in and sort of give in to that impulse.
Yeah.
That certainly was the case with me.
Right, of course.
I wouldn't have gone to a library and asked for books on... like an autistic man child.
yeah, that's right. Well, when you're on the internet, like, there's several levels of that. When you're on the internet, you're killing time.
Mm.
And so everything sort of comes bite-sized, and the links just lead one to another. And the name of your show is Down the Rabbit Hole, which is exactly right. Once you get a taste of this interesting thing, there's no friction. There's, whatsoever to chasing an interesting thread and finding more.
That's actually kind of something I wanted to talk about earlier, too, and I'm glad that we looped back around to it. You talked about the way that, like, sometimes the stories that I'm covering are almost hypnotizing.
Mm-hmm.
That It has partially to do with my construction of it, because the way that I construct it is very purposeful to induce that kind of feeling.
Hmm.
And most of my editing decisions and writing decisions, like scripting decisions, are quite purposeful to induce this feeling.
Mm-hmm.
But it also has to do with how I decided to tell the narrative. Rather than telling the narrative from the beginning, you'll remember, maybe, I did two different videos on the Final Fantasy house. I did the one that was the main video that was 40 minutes long, and then I did another video giving all the information chronologically. For the main video, my goal was to tell the story rather than in the order of events. I told it in the way that the internet learned about it, which was a lot more... It feels elusive.
Right. Well, it's sort of like a mystery story. And so you're gathering clues, and you're gathering clues at the rate that, you know, this body of people who are going down this rabbit hole together are unearthing them, right?
Mm-hmm. And I eventually realized, you know, this... That's typically how I do my videos anyway, but with the Final Fantasy house, it was extra confusing because... there was a lot of, like, he said, she said, and a lot of names. And a lot of pseudonyms as well. Most people had more than one name.
Right, right. That's very interesting. So the dramatic element to the video sort of, comes from this natural process of discovery and trying to puzzle everything together.
Yes.
Yeah.
I know that when I'm researching... I'm always fascinated with the way that I discover things, and also fascinated with how it would feel to discover things in, like, outside of chronological order, and I try to imagine what it would feel like to be one of those people on the ground learning about it as it went on, like, as everyone else was experiencing it, to be that person at ground zero, and I aim to recapture that feeling.
Sure.
Because the internet really does change the way that we... interface and understand things. I think that it's always kind of been that way for certain fields, like archaeology. You know, you learn things out of order. Science is pretty progressive. You sort of learn how things work on a progressive scale. But the internet, I think, has increased the frequency at which we learn things out of order. And just because of the availability of the information and how it becomes available.
Right, right. I've got this principle that everyone has their own cyberspace, because, you know, like, maybe if everyone logged into Reddit at the same time and everyone saw the same stories at the same time, there would be this sort of, you know, single internet that everyone was sharing in. But really, everyone's got their own order for things popping up, or either they see it on Facebook, or they see it days later, or someone mentions it. So everyone's experiencing... massive connected worlds in sort of their own direction at their own rate, and they're digging into it at their own volition.
Yeah, the world is less Asimovian and more Dickian.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's a good way to put it. So it's like, unless you're part of a large... And this was so much truer before, like, social media. Like, I was a member of, you know, Trek BBS and something off the web forums, and I would read fark.com every morning, right? So, right? So it's like there were all these many different communities that you could be a part of, or that you only heard about indirectly, right? And so the community as a whole might see the world together unfolding as, you know, as they discuss it from day to day. But now in social media, you have these colossal cosmopolitan sites like Twitter, where you're never going to see all of what happens on Twitter, and you're never going to see everything that happens on Reddit, because it's centralized, but this one central location is too big to cover with a cursory glance, right?
Correct. People curate their own version of the internet.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And often that curation, it's gotten more complicated in recent years as the forces that have created this space are pushing people into certain circles. I think the first time that happened on a really massive scale, I think, was when Facebook started categorizing people by political affiliation, simply by what articles they would interact with and what their friends were interested in and how they responded. Yeah, you can actually go onto Facebook and turn that off, by the way, in case you still use Facebook.
I remember doing that a few months ago and just turning off all the options that were like, oh, we're going to pigeonhole you and show you things that you like, right? I mean, so how long have you been using the internet, Frederick?
A lot. I got onto it a lot later than I think a lot of people. I wasn't around for Something Awful. I only really started digging into the internet, like, as a body.
Mm-hmm.
Late high school for me. So, like, I...
That's like the late noughts, the late 2000s, something like that?
Yeah, it's... I don't want to give too many hints to my age. I like being ageless.
That's fine.
But
that's fine.
But I wasn't around for a lot of this. I've had to sort of learn about it later on.
Well,
and it's fascinated me.
And that's what, I mean, wikis are for, right? Like, I mean, there's a million, like, everyone's heard of Wikipedia, but I mean, for lots of people for whom the phone was just an appliance that, you know, got swapped out for their flip phone by the salesman at you know, the cell phone store, right? And their only internet access is Twitter and Facebook, right? They've heard of Wikipedia, but they don't realize that anyone can set up their own encyclopedia database full of all of the lore and stories and archived material of, you know, the old forgotten days. I mean, the internet's been around the 80s, right? And
it's funny you say that. I have the Darkest Dungeon wiki open right now.
I don't think I've even checked that one out.
Oh, it's got everything from the game. I use it specifically so I don't screw up Curios.
Oh, right.
I don't know if you've ever played Darkest Dungeon.
No, I'm afraid not. But yeah, sure, every game and every fandom has been meticulously archived by some fan out there.
Yeah, and I think that actually is sort of another interesting element. Oh, voice cracks. I think that that's another interesting element to the internet, is that it's changed the way that we interface with our media. On a I keep saying that the internet hasn't changed things on a fundamental level. It's sort of worked backwards. We put our media on the internet, and then afterwards, the way that we interface with it has changed. You can say that our interfacing with our media is the most fundamental element of art and artistic expression. No, that has to be there. The person has to be able to interface with the art. But the internet has fundamentally changed the way that we do so. People can curate the way that they interact with things a lot more precisely. I can have the Darkest Dungeon wiki up while I'm trying to figure out Curios, even if part of the game design intended me to try to figure it out as I went along.
Yeah, yes. Having that supplement, I mean, I was playing like LucasArts adventure games in the 90s, and you know, a couple of them, when I bought them, had, you know, a hint book or a clue book, but if it didn't have that, there would be a 1-800 phone number where you could call in for, you know, tips and hints at, like, you know, $3.99 a minute.
Yes. Oh God. I never called those. I was always like, it's always so expensive.
Yeah,
$5 a month in
allowance. Rather spend 6 hours trying to figure out one stupid puzzle so I can get forward.
Mm-hmm. Money means very different things when you're a child.
Yeah, and now you play the same game again, and it's in an emulator, like ScumVM, or you can play all these games directly on archive.org, even. There's so many old video games that run right in a JavaScript virtual machine right on the page, right?
Well, I think you brought up something really interesting with virtual machines, because the way that you interface with a game on a virtual machine is quite different from the way that you might on a console. If only because the graphics are better. Like, you can see every horrendous polygon in Donkey Kong 64 if you run it through a virtual machine.
Oh, yeah.
But you can also run it at a halfway decent frame rate. It's, even if it was designed to be run on a weaker machine, we can change that. And I'm not, I know that generally people would say that's better. I would rather say it's different.
Right. Right, because, well, hell, yes, exactly. You can see flaws that perhaps your old CRT television wasn't revealing to you.
There was a video, yeah, there was a video I really liked, and who was it? They were talking about VHS. Was it Quentin Reviews? It might have been. I feel like he's it weirds me out that I have more subscribers than him, because that feels so wrong. He, like, all my friends know his name and, like, talk about him. But cut this out of the podcast. Don't, actually.
No, it's all good.
They were talking about the power of VHS. So when VHS was first coming out, there was definitely a decrease in quality, of course. But there was one particular kind of film that was enhanced by VHS, and that was horror. Because, like, imagine watching Alien, and, oh, you know, you, like, the fuzziness of the TV, you're looking in the shadows, you're like, oh, God, is that the xenomorph? You know, you're freaking out as a kid. But then you get the expanded edition, you know, the definitive edition, remastered, and suddenly you can see the shadows a lot more clearly, and you're not looking at them constantly to see if the xenomorph is coming up behind, because you'll be able to see immediately, because the quality is good enough. The medium, regardless of quality, will change your experience.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. I'm going to drag some Marshall McLuhan into this, just because he's my go-to guy for media. So according to his ideas, the medium is the message. And something small and blurry like a television leaves much more to the imagination to fill in. So yes. Marshall McLuhan would call television a cool medium because people have to kind of, yeah, like you say, their imagination is working overdrive to fill in all the missing details that aren't there in the low resolution.
Yeah, right. And I think that is something that modern augmented reality games are attempting to capture. I tend not to cover them on my channel very much. I leave that to Nightmind for the most part. But they do tend to have this aspect of things are locked away. There's more restriction upon the way that you can interact with it. That feels very similar to shadows in the image of a VHS.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Less is more. Well, that's the thing. Mm-hmm. I mean, sometimes it's counterintuitive to think about how constraints, having to fit yourself or fit your mind or to work within a tight set of constraints, really unleashes your imagination. Sort of like how video games, you know, with rules that force you to work within them, kind of bring out a whole bunch of creativity that a total open concept, too much freedom.
I think that it's not always accidental either. Like it's something that's been captured for a very, very long time. My favorite example is from one of my favorite books. Are you familiar with Dune by Frank Herbert?
Oh, I only got halfway through the novel, but you're not going to appreciate that. I really liked the David Lynch film version, for what it's worth.
Oh, that movie was garbage. You have
of course
terrible
it was,
taste now.
Because you read the book, right? Yeah.
No. I still, even if I hadn't read the book, the movie's a mess. It's gorgeous.
Oh, there, the there's a particular fan edit. There's a particular fan edit that I have that was really hard to find, that splices together 6 different versions, which are radically different, into a long, epic mega cut.
Oh dear.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Yeah. Right.
I'd be interested to see that. You should shoot that my way.
Absolutely.
But the point I was getting to. So in Dune, there is the ornithopter. There are the ornithopters. You remember those, right?
Mm, yeah.
Yeah. So for those listening who don't know what the ornithopters are, we have an audience. The ornithopters were basically a mode of air transport that was very common, almost like helicopters. However, their only description was that they were bug-like. That is literally all that Frank Herbert gave the reader to work off of. From there, the reader got to imagine what it looked like. And through that limitation, the story became more real, because you didn't have to know more. Like, Frank Herbert would only ever give you as much as you needed, because his books are thick.
Right.
And he doesn't have the time to detail all this crazy stuff. So he just gives you as much as you need and then lets you fill in the gaps. But it allows it to be more real, because you're the one who, in your mind, is constructing the ornithopter.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's
you
perfect.
You interface with it stronger. in my opinion. If done correctly, if done incorrectly, it's a frustrating mess.
Yeah, you can't tell what's going on. Like, how does this universe even work, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right.
You need to, like, you need to have everything necessary to understand the plot and the story, and you need to have something to hold on to. And sometimes all you need is bug-like.
Sure. Sure, of course. And then you've got, well, you've got the consistency of human nature in a book like Dune, I'm sure, where as long as all the characters are doing exactly what characters would do in any setting of that sort, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, Dune is very much about the inevitability of the political course and reality. He was a very strong believer in causality. I mean, I'm a strong believer in causality too, but I think he believed on it in it more on a larger level, where people are going to act a certain way, and the way that things, like the way that things will be, are already determined. That's
right.
A very strong theme.
Right, right.
Which actually kind of ties back into the internet and something I was hoping to chat with you about. Because I find this very interesting on the internet. People sometimes say that Chris Chan becoming popular online was an inevitability. And I'm curious to hear your perspective on it.
Oh, yeah. Well, so Chris Chan is... So he
you can
was
use another
creating,
example. I don't want to be another podcast talking about Chris Chan necessarily. You can pick someone else. You can think about
absolutely.
Jen.
Well, no, I think it's worth laying out to dig into the meat of what you're saying here. So,
sure.
Yeah, I mean, he created this character called Sonichu, which is a hybrid of Sonic the Hedgehog and Pikachu from Pokemon, right? So you've got this. I mean, seriously, in a world full of popular culture and popular media and all these different fandoms, which, I mean, is something that we've only really had. Like, I think James Bond in the 50s was the first major fandom sort of event that sort of normalized. And in the latter half of the 20th century, we sort of gotten used to this notion that the world is full of different franchises, and you got superhero movies, and you've got video game worlds and all that stuff, right? So yeah, like, the imagination... runs free in you know, our like wonderland of media worlds that we all like to take a few hours break from of escapism when we get off of work, right?
Yeah, if I can interject, there's actually a very old instance of this.
Hmm.
And it comes from something you might not expect. Are you familiar with the sequels to Don Quixote?
The sequels to Don? No, I'm not.
Okay, so Don Quixote was released. Hilarious. And people loved it so much that people started making their own unauthorized sequels. And there's no copyright back at that point.
Yeah.
So in order to combat this, the author had to write a sequel. Like a definitive sequel. Because he kept getting bootlegs. He kept getting bootleg fan fiction of Don Quixote. Because people loved it.
That's hilarious. That's awesome. I didn't know that. Yeah, of course. Here's my authoritative version. Well, that's so funny.
I believe it was Don Quixote. I'm like, it's been a few years since I heard that story from my professor, so I really hope I'm getting it completely right.
That would make sense, because that's definitely one of those sort of whimsical stories it's Protean. It captures something about the age, right? In the story, so it would lead itself to these sort of fancies and homages.
Exactly, and I think what you're getting at is that we sort of have a more extreme version of that. And then, you know what, I'll let you continue, because I have more to talk about this, but I keep interrupting you.
No, this is fine.
I've been really bad to you this whole time.
Hey, no, this is great, I'm sure. It's funny, because now I want to tell the story about how before Harry Potter 5, Order of the Phoenix, was going to be released, I downloaded a pirated early version off of Kazaa, and I read it first before everyone else, and I got to the very end of this, you know, like 500-page book when I realized it was a fan book, a fan fiction version. I was young and I should have figured it out sooner. There's all sorts of like clues and amateur things all around, but I had to work real hard to forget it all so that I could read the actual book. And I still get the two mixed up in my head because the stories are terrible, right? But anyway, So we were talking about, just in short, Chris Chan is just, you know, yes, he's an autistic guy who created his own mashup fantasy world of Sonic the Hedgehog with Pikachu, and so he produced so many comics and so many comics that, yeah, I think it was sort of deterministic, like, yes, he would inevitably have become famous for being so prolific in creating, because there's always fan fictions out there, but something as ridiculous as what he was putting out was always going to capture attention. And how people deal with internet fame is something also that, I mean, well, for instance, your video on TimeCube on Dr. Jean Ray. Like, I remember TimeCube in like 2002, 2003 on Fark.com. We were like, everyone loved TimeCube and thought it was ridiculous, right? And so here's a guy who found internet fame for creating something that was just that right level of ridiculous and absurd, but also, is this a parody? Is this person making fun of themselves, or are they actually this ridiculous? Right, you can't even tell, right? It's kind of like Poe's Law. And then how do you deal with that internet fame once it comes on to you, right? So if you look at how Chris Chan dealt with his celebrity, or how Gene Ray dealt with his celebrity, which, I mean, those are two videos I recommend to all of my listeners to check out on your channel. Because, I mean, this is something that inevitably, like, there are people out there producing content who are in waiting of their explosion of internet celebritydom coming up. Right, and they got lessons to learn from these characters, or from the Spoony one, or from anyone else, right?
I'm very fortunate that I have been, like, my rise has been synchronous with learning about these people and learning these lessons, right?
Yes, and not only that, not only did you learn from these lessons, you actually took the effort to encapsulate, to try to distill from these stories what the lesson is, and then remediate it out there for other people. And I think that's a very constructive, useful thing here. So thank you very much for doing that.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
So I actually disagree with you on one point.
Go ahead.
In your talking about it, I do not believe that Chris Chan's fate was so deterministic. Because I was really interested to learn how the internet first learned of Chris Chan. It was from someone for whom Chris had already become a pet project. They went on the Something Awful forums and they said, there's this dude in my town who's really weird. And she was kind of stalking him. The way that she describes it, it's kind of weird and sort of creepy. But she started talking about Chris Chan and Sonichu, and that's what got people interested. If this woman hadn't been creeping around and sort of stalking Chris, this wouldn't have happened. It was just one person who decided that they were particularly interested in this, like, autistic young man. And sometimes that's all it takes, is the one person deciding, yeah, sure, I guess this is worth my time.
Right. Well, there
often
you go.
the people who would be truly earnestly interested in it wouldn't discover it except for someone whose reaction was, meh, I guess I'll share this.
Right. So that's, well, there's sort of this Johnny Appleseed thing going on, which sort of seems to be the boundary between, right, the actions of an individual and then the sort of cultural things at large that one might view as deterministic. So I like that you said Asimovian earlier. I assume you're talking about, like, psychohistory, Harry Seldon's psychohistory from the Foundation books.
I was referring specifically more to the way that Asimov seems to view society as one great collective whole. In contrast to Philip K. Dick, who still sees people as extremely individualistic and driven a lot more by individual desires.
Right.
But I do know what you are speaking of when you speak of Harry Seldon.
Yeah, because in psychohistory was all about the determinism of history and everything being inevitable in broad strokes, and people just play their part in this inevitable grand picture. But
I'm actually reading through the Foundation series right now. I just finished the first book.
Oh, recently. Great. Yeah. Those are some of my favorites, and
excellent. Yeah.
Yeah, we're So there's this idea of Chris Chan's this woman who sort of, you know, spread the word about him first and planted these seeds of interest, which caused a critical mass of people to be interested in him, so as to you know, light the tinder that exploded his notorious internet celebridom. Sometimes it's interesting because what you're doing there is you're crossing the boundary between the individual, right? This, and then the collective currents of how information like memes pass around in our modern day environment. Because I think that's right at the level where everyone sort of ends up getting a different, totally rapidly different interpretation of events that are like spread through the media. So you hear a story about, oh, this sort of person did that sort of thing, and it's part of a trend. Whereas if you people who take the time to dig into the particulars and look into an individual as a more complex thing will be like, well, no, in this particular part, it bucks the trend, right? There's people looking for patterns in the world who need everyone to be two-dimensional, stereotypical characters, and then the patterns are everywhere.
It's kind of interesting the way that you're talking about it, because the first thing I think is I think you're sort of speaking to the viral nature of the internet a little bit more. Sort of the feeling that, oh, this person is this way, and so they have what it takes to go viral, right? Which is kind of interesting in the modern context, because now viral sensations can be engineered. And they often are, especially with certain music videos. The platforms on which things go viral have very predictable algorithms that go along with them, and it is possible to game those algorithms, but also screw with those algorithms to make something viral where it otherwise would not have been. Often something that has had a lot of money behind it. But we also have these incidental things, and I think that these incidental things that go viral, like Gene Ray or Chris Chan, or the Final Fantasy House, even back in its day, I'd say that that story went viral.
It did.
Those are a lot. Yeah, I mean, I'd heard about it a long time ago. It's sort of a piece of internet lore at this point, but they are not so certain. And they can bubble up out of nowhere. And I think for some people, it's magical. You can't always predict what's going to go viral, because it's usually an accident of circumstance. That's my belief. After looking at it for so many hours, looking at all these different things for so many hours, I'm convinced that these things are not inevitable. There are plenty of weirder people than Chris Chan hiding away on the internet. They just won't necessarily gain the same sort of traction.
You sort of have to win the lottery or the slot machine of having enough bumps or enough people keeping it alive until it finally tips some threshold.
Not just the right number of people, but the right people. The people who might be connected to the right people at the right time. And when I say time, I sometimes mean a course of hours where people would see someone else talking or posting about something.
No, that makes a lot of sense. And so when you talk about people gaming the system, right? Like, yes, once you see how it works, now I suppose that's you're more I'm going to use the phrase media literate. Once you understand how things go viral, which is obviously something that marketing companies wanted to figure out as quickly as possible. Once they understood the nature of the internet, right? Right, so once they became media literate and they figured it out, and there's like, all right, as long as you get some YouTube celebrity with, you know, at least 100,000 viewers to talk about a thing, you can, and you also get, you know, a Twitter hashtag trending at, you know, 2 o'clock in the afternoon in the East Coast or whatever the hell it is, right? Like, there's people trying to crunch the numbers on the system just to figure out how to create it, right? So there's a sort of arms race going on, but also you end up with the audience becoming more savvy in detecting these manipulations too, and always trying to look for the authentic and you know, and getting pissed off at, say, like, Wendy's and Burger King having a Twitter fight with their mascots or something stupid like that, right?
Yeah, I think that the internet is very scary for both corporations and governments. I think that one of the best examples is, what was it, Article 31 in Europe that was saying, like, oh, you know, you have to have the rights to literally everything that you publish, you know, fair use or not.
Mm-hmm.
Like, basically throwing out fair use on the internet.
Mm-hmm.
And it's... they did it like without even understanding how the internet works and how impossible it would be to create and curate, like have a bot curate
exactly
everything that is uploaded. Like these old people, these old codgers sitting in their comfy chairs, sipping at their coffee with too much cream, like talking about, oh yeah, like they don't know what the internet is.
No, they were taught that it's a series of platforms, right? There's platforms, and then everyone's a platform owner, and every platform is a corporation subject to law. And so what more do they possibly need to know, right? You regulate the platform.
Exactly. Great. Exactly. But even more so, it is a platform that can make or break them. And you never know who it's going to hit next or what it's going to do. That's scary.
It's terrifying.
And so you're a politician or you're a corporation like manager. You hear about that, you want to lock that down.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that what terrifies those governments and those corporations so much, the thing that they are trying to exploit in turn, is also what makes the internet so interesting, is there's a word for it. I was trying to use it earlier. That it's the same word I was freaking out about. It's a word that refers to things that occur as a matter of things progressing that are not necessarily intended. Help me out here. I keep wanting to say extant, but it's not extant.
Stochastic.
Definitely. Literally any other hour of any other day, I'd be able to tell you the word, and I'm going crazy here.
Okay, we'll edit it into the video if.
All right, no.
Figure it
there,
out.
These crazy factors. There's so much going on the internet.
Well, it's like an emergent phenomenon, right? You never know.
That's the word I'm looking for. Emergent.
Mm.
There we go.
Perfect.
Thank you so much.
No problem.
The emergent phenomena of the internet are what make it is what makes it so powerful. Yes, because phenomena, plural.
Yeah.
The emergent phenomena are what make the internet so powerful. It's what these platforms are trying to regulate by creating more and more specific algorithms and more, I literally just forgot the word again. help me.
They're constraining and they're shaping the what is emerging, and they're trying to channel it.
They're trying.
Yeah.
They're trying to control these emergent properties, but the more they try to lock it down, the more emergent properties occur.
The tighter you grip your hand, Tarkin, the more star systems squeeze through your fingers.
Pretty much. It's when you have this many people connected in such a direct way, you are going to continue to observe these emergent properties. You are going to continue to see these Christians and these Final Fantasy houses and like people misinterpreting the Mouse Utopia experiments and creating their own websites and creating new conspiracy theories, mm-hmm. new shapes for the globe to be.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to keep happening.
I agree. I think what you're getting at, I'm going to phrase it how I've been thinking of it, is that, you know, the future is going to be full of interesting cults, and we're just kind of we're just at the beginning of it. Because if people mm-hmm. stop believing in their regular story and then they start doing their research, like I'm sure both you and I and many of our listeners have got a friend or a cousin who out there who's implored them, well, if you would just do your research and then go on some crazy story about whatever the hell it is, right? People are going to start making up their own realities when the one that the mainstream media is telling them doesn't quite fit anymore.
Yeah, you're touching on something that I believe very deeply. And that's that the information age is not about finding correct information. It's about a glut of information. It's mm-hmm. about information everywhere, whether it is correct or not.
Glut is the word used by Neil Postman, and he was using that
is
word.
Is it?
In 1992, you can see him on PBS going, we are going to have an information glut, and there's going to be so much information, we won't even know how to sort through it.
He was right.
Yeah.
He was absolutely correct. Search algorithms have done a fair bit to help that, but those algorithms can be gamed extremely easily.
Absolutely. And when you rely on a search algorithm instead of relying on your own human intelligence, when you like offset your own or outsource or externalize your own sense making apparatus to this, you know, 21st century command line, because that's what it is. It's like you're asking the computer on Star Trek, tell me about this, right? You just type it into Google and you accept whatever Google feeds at you. I mean, my approach to the internet, I really try to look at it like a library where you're still going to have to spend 45 minutes rooting down the information that you want. It's just you don't have to walk so much past the shelves of books.
Right. This is the postmodern nightmare. There's more information than a human being with our biological limitations can possibly glean and sort through and critically analyze. I think that there is a strong emphasis, you know, everyone of every political affiliation says just think critically, but it is impossible to think critically with a full idea of every facet of what you're looking at.
Mm-hmm. I mean,
just because there's so much information available.
Yes. I mean, there are razors you can use to slice away what's easily dismissible, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
As a rational, skeptical atheist, I'm going to slice away lots of stuff that blatantly breaks the laws of physics, right? Or I'm going to reframe, you know, oh, I've got this object and it has magical properties that gets me through things. I'm going to think, well, that's, you know, the positive thinking in your psychology, that this, the comfort you get from this thing. It's not actually giving off, you know, magic crystal healing waves or whatever the hell explanation you're actually telling yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So there's all these sort of cognitive tricks that we can have. But nevertheless, at the end of the day, we are swimming in a sea of overinformation. So as you plumb down all of these different depths and all these different rabbit holes, like for instance the Osho guy, into that, because that was a cult that was going on in, I guess, the late 70s, right?
Yeah. It started in the 60s. Indian gurus have been like really popular in the West since the New Age movement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what are some of your strategies then for dealing with information glut that might help some of my listeners?
So if you really, really want to dig in and you want to find information about a topic that you are truly interested in, the trick is extremely simple. It's keywords. You need to find the right keywords. When I am digging into a topic, I'll look at something that maybe glazes over the topic at first. Because, I mean, that's all you're going to really be able to find unless you want to sort through everything.
Mm-hmm.
So to make things more efficient, I will go to a large overarching source or arching.
Mm-hmm.
And I will find the keywords that seem a little bit strange or maybe esoteric. And then I'll start using those in conjunction with some larger words to make sure that I'm still in the correct realm. And then I will continue refining, adding keywords until I get as close to the source as I possibly can.
Mm-hmm. And if you can find a dead link, then you can try looking it up on the archives at archive.org, maybe, or something.
Correct.
Like that.
Or oftentimes the page itself will not be archived, but the content will be. And if you can figure out what a little bit of that content was, you might be able to find it archived in a different way.
Mm-hmm. I like that you...
There are a lot of small tricks, is what I'm getting at, that
course.
I just kind of have found through experience. But the biggest one is start broad, find specifics.
Right. Find those words which will only probably crop up within the context of the precise thing that you're looking for. And yeah, that's a good approach, and I like you spelling it out that way because it sort of reveals a way I think the internet or the World Wide Web, hypertext, has shaped our thinking, because hypertext is full of links. But what you're doing when you pull a keyword out of a text and you search it is you're kind of making your own hyperlink. You don't have to rely on just clicking the links that the author put in their documents. Every single word in any text is something searchable. So every single word and every single symbol on the internet is itself kind of a hyperlink if you do the hard work, I guess, of copying and pasting it into a box.
Yes, that is absolutely correct. Text is no longer just text. When I was in college, I did independent study, like directly under a professor, into cybertext, using Espen J. Arseth's book, Cybertext, as sort of a core to construct a theory of, like, an extra sort of theory of interactive media. And God, I really ought to get that back together and publish it at some point in one form or another. But I am extremely interested in the way that people interface with interactive texts and media. And of course, you know, the earliest cybertexts are always hypertext. For those of you who don't know, by the way, we're using a little bit of jargon. Hypertext just refers to text on a screen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
it's that simple.
People who have watched my documentary series Silicon and Charybdis will know that it was innovated in the 60s by Doug Engelbart when he invented the mouse and his abstract way of linking together text in new dynamic interactive forms, right? That's what I've been working on. It's taken me a year. I've watched 100 hours of computer documentary footage, and I've tried to stitch together the creation of the content of computers as a simulatory cyberspace, which is totally divorced from the actual hardware, right? I want to explain why people are so dumb when it comes to understanding what computers are, but they feel so smart by knowing how to use them, right, in the totally abstract fictional interfaces, which are high level and totally divorced from the actual reality of, you know, a CPU or whatever, right?
Yes.
Because I think that contributes a lot to the postmodern conundrum of reality melting together when there aren't enough eyeballs out there articulating the underlying substrate of the information medium itself. So
it's something that cyberpunk texts have been very interested in. Text being any sort of media.
Oh, sure.
I should specify.
William Gibson's Neuromancer, when I was reading that, right? It's like,
oh, what a trip.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I mean, it's I think there's a big digital divide between people who see their computer or their phone as a tool, right? Oh, it's the thing I typed up my resume on. Or, you know, it's the thing that replaced my cell phone versus people. There's so many people growing up today who are creating their own world, right? It's more appropriate to think of the internet as a cyberspace for them, right? Like people in the furry fandom, which you look at your video before they show up at a convention, then all they have is this digital environment which speaks directly to, you know, what their fantasies or their passions are, but while their minds are active exploring all this stuff, they're sitting on their ass behind a chair. And I wonder what that level of mind body connection or disconnection, or how much are heavy internet users affected in their identity formation when they discover themselves online as opposed to discovering themselves by going out to a club or something as they might have done 30, 40 years ago to find people who they can relate to.
Right. That's something that I've considered a lot. I, especially as, a bachelor living alone and working from home, the relationships that I form with people online, I have quite a few online friends. And even, my friends, like my college buddies, I still interact with them online sometimes. Not as much, but I think about it regularly, the way that the internet has changed the way that human interaction works. But I also have kind of come to accept the fact that the internet has not fundamentally changed the way that human interaction works and what it means on that level. Because consider us talking. When we are talking simply with voice, that is essentially, it is essentially as if we are talking with a wall between us, with no ceiling. We can hear each other, but we're still interacting. And interaction is, like, human interaction is already largely a very abstract sort of thing. If you want to get very specific with it and very postmodern with it, even if I were to punch you in the face, which I wouldn't do, by the way. I hate violence and I've never been in a fight in my life. I've done sports, but, like, I've done contact sports, but I haven't fought. I would not punch you in the face, but if I were to punch you in the face... the interaction is more between your nerves and your brain than it is my fist and you as an individual. So there's always that layer.
So it's different to punch Tyler Durden or to punch Mike Tyson than it would be to punch, you know, the dork with glasses who never got punched, because the interaction with his brain would feel a lot more stronger.
Well, the reality is that you are a self-encased organism, and things outside of you can interact with you, but the most direct, everything that we are doing to interact with each other is incorporeal, essentially. It's information.
Mm-hmm.
And the internet allows for that information to pass. So I think that it's really interesting the way that you're talking about it, how... the internet is a sort of fake reality, whereas I don't necessarily see it that way. It certainly is in some regards. When I am driving a car in a video game, I am not driving a car in real life. Mm-hmm. Like, no matter how realistic it may be, like, even if my body is experiencing it differently, you know, now we're going full Matrix,
right?
But right. Like, no, well, I prefer reality. Like, I am a kind of person who prefers reality.
Mm-hmm.
But I also recognize that there are very real experiences that I can have on the internet or in an electronic medium that affect me on a personal, emotional, and logical level.
Absolutely.
And well, they may be different than those that reality might provide. Like, I love scuba diving.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's something that I cannot do online. I can play Subnautica. I love Subnautica.
Absolutely.
But it's not actually diving.
Well, all right. So there's this large overlap. There's this large, like, if there's a Venn diagram, there's so many experiences, like us talking, that can exist face-to-face or can exist in the way we're doing it now. But you can't punch me in this medium, whereas you could in reality. And I can't appear to you as, you know, an avatar of whatever wild Second Life creation that I identify as in reality, unless I'm wearing a, you know, some very expensive costume that I paid someone in the furry fandom to make for me, right? I think just the blurring of these lines at all without any sort of distinction, I think that the determinism comes from people sufficiently explicitly articulating the difference between the mediated experience and the real life experience, especially when they are so similar, like a boyfriend and a girlfriend, or, you know, two girlfriends or two boyfriends getting into a fight over a text message is very different from them shouting at each other face to face, right? But you can say, oh, I got into a fight with my girlfriend last week, and not say whether it was a text message or say whether it was, you know, in person. And that might have been...
I actually disagree with you heavily.
Oh.
In this particular instance.
Oh.
I think what you're pointing out is an issue of linguistics. Because the word fight just has multiple meanings. And that's the problem that's coming into play. However, the emotional impact that a couple may be having on each other through a text message fight is just as real as if they were fighting in reality. And that's kind of the point I'm getting at.
All right.
I do not believe that there is a true separation of soma and psyche. And that experience online is real. It just has different effects.
Right. Well,
does that make
sense?
Like, you are obviously not actually driving a car online. I feel like I need to make this specific to people listening.
Yeah.
You are not literally driving a car if you're driving a car in GTA 5. Mm-hmm. The experience is entirely different, but the experience is still real, just in a different way. especially in terms of human interaction. Because I may not be able to punch you because you're across the internet, but the same holds true if there's a wall in the way with no ceiling.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Fair enough. I mean, the threat is more real. I think that the two situations, though, are not equivalent. It's not the same effect.
Absolutely. No, they are very different.
There can be an intensity.
I absolutely agree with that.
There can be an equality of intensity. The fight might hurt as much one way or another, but it's going to be taking a different form. And someone who is comfortable expressing themselves, orally with the full, you know, complimentation, like with all their expression of body, right? Maybe they can't write a text message that demonstrates their emotions, right? So, So the quality of the event is going to make a big difference. And I think it's just when people are sloppy telling the story to themselves, oh, we had a fight. Maybe people are taking for granted that people used to not be able to fight in conversational text, because conversational text itself as a medium has only been around for a couple decades. Like, a letter used to take a week to arrive in a mailbox. Yeah. There's no such thing as conversational text before modems, right?
Sure. Yeah, I see what you're getting at.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I think that we have come to a consensus.
All right. Absolutely. Now, you've got a channel. It's your name, Fredrik Knudsen. That's Fredrik with a K, no C, and Knudsen, K-N-U-D-S-E-N.
Yes. You can probably find it easier by Googling down the rabbit hole. It's
perfect.
The one with the wicked logo.
Perfect. And if you like his stuff, absolutely. I encourage you to sponsor Fredrik on Patreon, because his material is worth it.
I have a few things I need to do for my patrons. Thank you very much. If any of you are listening, thank you very, very much. But I have a few things I need to get done for them. I need to get the Q&A video together as well.
Okay.
And then I need to keep working on the next video, because this one is looking kind of really massive and I really want to get it out in a timely fashion.
Oh, awesome. All right. Well, everyone listening will have a fun few hours going down the rabbit hole with Fredrik Knudsen. Oh, I'm also on Patreon at clinchinthegeek.com if you like this podcast, or Silicon and Charybdis. So thanks for joining me, and we'll see you all next time on Life in the Foam. Take care, guys. Thank you very much.